found it started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. Just like Donald Trump starting to burn just about everything he finds. Unbelievable what's going on in this amazing administration. We have two great guests to talk about it today. Don Goldmacher, you with us from Berkeley, California?
Yes, sir.
And Bob, my co-conspirator, Bob Patricus, are you on from Ohio? I guess Bob's not on with us. Before we go, Don, I know that Bob, you there? No, Bob's not with us. So, Don, I know you and I are going to have a great hour talking about some, but I got to keep stuff in perspective here. And I got to say that in preparing for the show, I came across one of the most astonishing pieces of news I've ever read, which is that a Torah scholar, a great Jewish sage, has discovered what he believes is a loophole in the kosher laws that will now allow Orthodox Jews to eat bacon. So, you know, I thought that was a perfect news item in keeping with Donald Trump and what's going on here. So I'm sure that Donald will come out soon with a major statement on Jews eating bacon. I'm sure the Kushner family will be extremely interested in that one. So there you go. And Bob Patrick is going to join us momentarily, I'm sure, my co-conspirator. Our book, The Strip and Flip Disaster of America's Stolen Elections, is finished. It's going to be online momentarily. We'll have it for the Web Forum in New York in June, and that's a great thing. So, Don, where we have a full hour here. Where do we start with this astounding, just indescribable caravan of insanity coming out of the Trump administration? I mean, it's staggering.
Yeah. Well, I think part of what we should start with is to understand it's a spectacle in part, and we should not lose sight of the bigger picture here, which is the Republican Party controls the House, the Senate, the presidency, and the Supreme Court. And they have a radical right-wing agenda. So in some ways, it almost doesn't matter who occupies the presidency, because let's assume the best case scenario, Donald Trump is forced to resign or is impeached or whatever. Who steps in? Mr. Pence.
Well, Mike Pence.
Who is Mr. Pence? He's a Christian theocracy advocate. So we move from fascism to Christian theocracy, which is another form of fascism. The Handmaid's Tale, you know, that was brilliantly written by the brilliant woman up in Canada. I am blocking her name right now, but it's been made into a television series of all things that's currently being broadcast. So even though we can, you know, revel it from one moment to the other, that's precisely the point I wanted to make to your audience, that we must begin to think and operate strategically. We cannot go from moment to moment, from reacting to this, reacting to that, what I used to call decades ago mindless activism. We must be strategic. We must have an overarching strategy of how we are going to not only stop and resist this right-wing onslaught, but how we are going to implement a real democracy in this country. And, of course, you and Bob, you know, have been on this case for a couple of decades in terms of you cannot have a democracy if you cannot verify voting. So, but I don't want, again, to us just stay with that particular issue, though that's the foundational issue. It's the underlying premise of democracy. If you cannot have a free and fair vote, whereby you can actually watch the votes being counted, not electronically, but with eyeballs and hands, then you don't have a functioning democracy. So part of building a social movement and ultimately a political party that will win needs an underlying grand strategy for that to take place. And what I mean by that is the strategy has to be built on four premises. And I'm trying to find my notes here where...
Bob Patricus, have you joined us? Bob, are you there yet?
No.
No, Bob's not with us yet.
Okay,
oh,
so
Bob,
not...
you are.
Sorry?
Has Bob joined us yet? Bob Fitrakis?
No, it's still just me.
Okay.
So what I want to say is that the way you conduct a grand strategy is through nonviolent struggle, which is a much more complex and varied room of struggle rather than violence. And this struggle is fought by psychological, social, economic, and political weapons applied by the social movements, the population, and the democratic institutions of society. So when you break that down into what that means, so you're talking everything from protests, strikes, non-cooperation, boycotts, disaffection. These are some of the ways you implement it. There are 200 specific methods of nonviolent action that Gene Sharp has identified in his classic now treatise called From Dictatorship to Democracy. And my whole point of being on the show is for people to go to the website where they can download and read this manual of resistance of overthrowing authoritarian governments and implementing democracy. The website is aeinstein.org. And I'll repeat that again. It's aeinstein.org. And I encourage all of your listeners to go there, read it, and share the document widely.
All right, well, let's go through this. Bob Fitrakis, you've joined us. I want to wish you a hearty mazel tov on the birth of our new book on election theft, the strip and flip disaster of America's stolen elections. Congratulations. I know you missed the top of the hour, so we're also announcing that Jews can now eat bacon. Where are you? Bob, are you in Columbus?
Yeah, I am in Columbus, Ohio.
All right.
Hey,
so
Bob.
We got Berkeley, we got Columbus, and we got Los Angeles here. I'm lying out in the sun in Los Angeles, which is surprisingly cold. I got to say, man, this town is much colder than I thought it would ever be. But here we
come
go.
Come up to Berkeley. It's getting warm.
Yeah. I did get to see Amy Goodman last night. She spoke in Koreatown at a big church, and she's fantastic, as always, pushing for KPFA. And Pacifica. So, Bob, we're talking now, you know, this endless parade of insanity from Donald Trump. I mean, you know, I never thought he would be this incredibly entertaining. I loved every minute of Watergate. I mean, I just was glued to the tube. I thought it was one of the greatest events in world democracy, ridding ourselves of this madman. Unfortunately, you know, Jerry Ford is a raging liberal compared to Mike Pence. And so I think we want to talk this hour about alternative strategies to, impeachment, which, you know, is most likely not going to happen. And if it did happen, I don't see any indication that Mike Pence, aside from his politics, is any more qualified or capable of handling the presidency than Trump has been. I mean, one thing you had to say for Nixon, he could run the government. He was capable of running the government. What's clearly happened now with this right-wing fascist, aside from his policies, is that he's not capable of running the operation of the government. Bob, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it's this reality TV show called The Incredibly Bad Apprentice. or sort of a buffoonish son of a rich exploitive capitalist uses his various connections and, you know, perhaps money laundering for the Russian mob to ascend to the highest office. And then, you know, we take enjoyment by seeing the fact that he's absolutely untrained. I mean, there was a little of that in George W. Bush, but, you know, he could be in trouble now. I mean, once you start affecting the stock market, the 1% will tolerate many things, Harvey. But once their money starts evaporating because you're an unqualified buffoon who can't add any stability to the system, I mean, really, there's – I know all these people, they're all suffering, you know, Trump anxiety disorder, when people are having trouble sleeping and you're affecting the entire economy of the world, some action will be taken.
Well, I'm certain that Prozac sales are skyrocketing at this point. I mean, you know, but it's true. People are completely, you know, a lot of people haven't recovered from election night. It's like being, you know, in Vietnam and getting hit with a shell nearby. I mean, this is really serious psychological trauma here.
And a lot of them, it goes into a notion that our system, you know, is just and it's a democracy. And what he's doing, you know, goes against any impulse towards democracy. It pretty much shows the system was up for sale and, you know, the infotainment society and the weapons of mass distraction, you know, could prevail if they wanted to.
It is truly amazing. Today he came out and said that, of course, he's accusing the appointment of this special prosecutor as being part of a witch hunt and saying it's a bad day for America.
In hyperbole, Harvey. The greatest witch hunt in the history of the world. Against me, the best president who ever lived in the first 100. I mean, everything is such an exaggerated, hyperbolic statement. It's a bit difficult to consume.
I have to say, though, that I think in a lot of ways you have to be thankful for what a buffoon Trump is. God forbid somebody should have come into office with his politics who was competent, like, say, Ronald Reagan. You know, Reagan had his intellectual shortcomings, but he was capable. He ran an administration. He ran the government. There's no doubt about it.
I'm not sure, though, after he was shot. I mean, they were talking about the 25th Amendment with him. I mean, he was at that certain point where he couldn't tell a movie from reality, although the guiding principles were clearly him. But I don't know. Increasingly, people are talking about the use of the 25th Amendment. We got Donald Goldmacher here. Maybe he can step in, right? I mean, it's literally, you know, the probating of the president because he appears to be, you know, mentally incompetent to run the government. And Nixon got that way only in the final days. We know from the book, right, where he was sort of chronically inebriated and talking to portraits of Abe Lincoln, and they had to send in General Haig. They literally sent in General Haig. So if Nixon was trying to, you know, start a nuclear war, it's that Haig wouldn't enter the codes.
Yeah, that's right. Don, are you familiar with the 25th Amendment?
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
Well, it essentially says if the president is not competent to serve, he's removed, right?
By whom?
Or at least the vice president.
Yeah, he's disabled. Whatever that
mentally
would be, physically or mentally.
Yeah.
But it's the cancer.
Look, Bob referred to me because I'm a psychiatrist, so I'll weigh in here in terms of his mental state as I view it from afar. Obviously, he's a pathological narcissistic disorder, meaning he's extremely underneath, very insecure, which results in him behaving in a way to defend against that insecurity all the time by using all his grandiose language and saying, I'm the greatest, we're going to have the greatest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we're all very used to that by now, that posturing. We're all, you know, seeing now this guy doesn't sleep very well because he's tweeting at 3, 4, 5 in the morning. And so God knows what he does take to sleep or to stay awake all that much. His attention span is very short. You know, I was puzzling the other day of why he doesn't read and whether, in fact, he might have a dyslexic disorder going way back in time. So he's not very capable of reading. So he has to watch movies or television or whatever. Ronald Reagan, as we know, used to love to watch movies all the time in the White House. But I don't think he's mentally incompetent. I think that, you know, and I've heard other psychiatrists opine he certainly is. This guy is crazy like a fox. Like all authoritarian, you know, figures from the past and the present, he knows what he wants to have happen. Part of why he's having so much trouble is because he's only used to having run a private corporation where he had lackeys surrounding him all the time, so nobody could challenge him. He didn't have to run a government where, in fact, a bureaucracy can challenge him every single day in many, many different ways to obstruct what he really wants to do. So there's a level of incompetency there, and obviously a number of the people he's brought in are less than competent. And so you have a very chaotic organization, number one, plus, you know, this whole Russia connection is very serious. You know, I've seen people on the left say, oh, no. Au contraire, I think there is something there. But again, Trump, I think now is a bit scared, shall we say, because the hounds are closing in. In a way, I don't even like the idea of a special prosecutor, because that's going to allow him to remain in office for a long time until, quote, they come up with something. I may be wrong on that. So we'll have to see how it plays out. But I don't think you can invoke the 25th Amendment at this point, unless he really starts to behave more bizarrely than he currently does. But within the context of who he is, his behavior is not any different than it was in the past, before he became president.
Well, my understanding of the 25th Amendment is that the decision has to be made by the cabinet. The cabinet has to, and this cabinet, these guys are just as crazy as he is. I mean, you're gonna have
right.
Rick Perry passing on the sanity of Donald Trump. I mean, you know, come on, that's like beyond the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, these guys, Rex Tillerson, for God's sake, Betsy DeVos, these people are gonna decide whether Donald Trump is sane. I mean, you know, so to me, the 25th Amendment sounds like a good strategy in a world that's not run by the caterpillar on the mushroom, but I don't think it's going to work.
And
given
again, Harvey, it's a tactic. It's not a strategy. So if you wanted to propose a better tactic, we should say that the election that occurred in November 2016 was, on the face of it, illegal, and we should call for a new presidential election.
What are your criteria?
Sorry?
What are your criteria? We have Bob Patrakis with us, one of the leading experts on
it
all.
First of all, you have to identify true interference by the Russians in the election through the use of social media and other ways, through possibly financing Trump's campaign and other things that they're sniffing around at. But once you've assembled, you know, probable cause, Bob, you should say you declare the election null and void, which would be a first in American history. Bob, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, clearly there's a variety of evidence there, and rather than the special prosecutor on Trump, I'd much rather see a real investigative task force. There's something I included in the article, the last one I put out with Harvey. There's a non-randomized digit returns in Wisconsin. That is, you know, 0 to 9. You'd expect each to be right around 10% for each of the 0 to 9, the 10 numbers. But just two of those numbers, 0 and 5, had more than 50%, like 53% of the results. Now, in any major election on earth in a democracy, that type of non-randomized result would immediately have nullified the election. Clearly, it's a sign that somebody had tampered with the results in Wisconsin.
Also, Bob, the fact that I didn't understand your description of what happened in Wisconsin, so I'm suspecting the audience didn't as well. Why don't you lay it out a little bit more?
In the modern, the law of large numbers, you've got 0, you got 1 through 9, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Now, when you look at election results by precincts, because there's so many of these precincts, you expect that almost every one of those numbers is going to be around 10%. Why? There's 10 of them. Zero is going to be around 10%. One's going to be around 10%. Two, three, four, five, all the way up to nine, because they occur over and over again, you know, in thousands of precincts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Wisconsin, two numbers, you know, the voting returns, as you look at them, there's two numbers, zero and five, that occur 53% of the time. That's impossible in a truly free and random election. If you've got those numbers, zero and five, occurring 53% of the time, it's a sign that somebody has tampered or hacked with the precinct voting numbers.
Well, in terms of the hacking of the 2016 election, and this is where we get down to the nitty-gritty, okay, we have questions about impeachment. A, will this Republican Congress ever impeach Donald Trump? It's not out of the question, but it's, you know, it's pretty close to being out of the question. B, if you do impeach him, you wind up with this stellar cast: Mike Pence, Rex Tillerson, Paul Ryan, and Mitch McConnell. Those are the next four guys in line to be president of the United States. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's a deep bench there. So impeachment really does us no good whatsoever.
Right.
And in fact, it's a detriment. So then you say, well, how do we remove this guy? And the answer has to be the nullification of the presidential election, which, of course,
right,
which has never happened in U.S. history. And there is zero mention of the possibility of nullifying an election in the Constitution of the United States. It's never even been an issue. There has never been raised in the politics, in the political history of the United States since 1789 and the ascendance of George Washington to the presidency. There has never been raised the possibility of nullifying an election. And to my knowledge, I don't think state, local, federal, I don't think an election, any election, has ever been nullified in U.S. history. Bob, do you know of any?
None stick out in my mind. I mean,
there's no legal, historical, or political precedent for nullifying an election. But this is where it gets interesting. Now, Don, you mentioned the Russian use of social media. We also, I suppose, can talk about campaign funding. We can also talk about sabotaging the Democrats, which, you know,
all of which,
like, you know,
if they are illegal acts, if they are illegal acts, and we believe they are, should be grounds to challenge the entire election.
Yeah,
right?
But there's
now
really,
I know there's no historical precedent, but if it's illegal, why should it be allowed to continue? And you see, and I don't even want to use constitutional language here, because you have to frame this illegality in the way that the masses will say, yeah, why should we abide by this election when it's just been proven that it was fraudulent? And, you know, in other countries, they topple governments for this very reason.
Okay,
and,
but you know what?
It's never happened here, but maybe it's time to try.
Well, to me, to my mind, and Bob, I want you to comment on this, the only thing I think that would give sufficient legal grounds, political and constitutional, to overturn the 2016 election is if the Russians or somebody else is proven to have manipulated the vote count.
Oh, the vote count.
Would you agree with that, Bob?
Yeah, I think if there's, in a special investigation, if it turns up that they tampered, you know, not just with, you know, say, leaks that went to WikiLeaks, but in any way interfered with vote tabulations and results, you'd have to nullify the election. I mean, on the surface, the data was there suggesting that, you know, the results made no sense in the first place. The problem we have, and all of us are aware of this, is that, you know, you're looking for Russian hacking when the reality is, you know, you've got private companies with the keys to the kingdom
right,
that could have easily just walked in and programmed the results.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you
as
also
you guys
have
very well documented has happened in the past.
Right.
Absolutely. We found the back door here in Ohio. You know, in 04, we found out our votes were counted in Chattanooga, Tennessee, by a born-again Christian evangelical, yep, Jeff Averbeck. You know, when Kerry was winning, and then plausibly there was a last-second vote shift, of 6% of the vote, more than that, that was sent in over the Internet, and clearly was false.
Yeah, and, I mean, the bottom line here is, people are talking about the Russians. I do want to discuss this whole Russia situation a bit. It's a little disturbing. But if we can show that the election results were somehow tangibly hacked. Now, Bob, you're saying we got to be able to look at the pre-programming of the electronic voting machines. Now, 80% of the votes in the country were cast or counted on electronic machines. Now, a lot of that, of course, is Scantron ballots, which are run through Scantron readers, so you technically have some kind of paper trail, but we know those are manipulated. And the election officials have not allowed recounts of Scantron balloting. You know, I always run around and say, well, we can always recount it because it's on Scantron, but then they don't let you do it, right? Didn't you encounter that, Bob?
Yeah, 49% of the, only 49% of the votes were counted in Wisconsin, including areas like Milwaukee that had Scantrons. But, their idea of a recount was you run the Scantron through the machine again. I mean, that's not a recount. That's testing your machine to see if it if stuff runs through it.
Yeah, right. So, at this point, to overturn the 2016 election, which I think is the only way that we come out of this in any way, shape, or form whole prior to the 2020 election, which I can't imagine 4 years of this, is to find a way somehow to do something that's never been done in U.S. history, not even close. Now, one thing we also saw statistically, Bob, is that Hillary Clinton won the exit polls in Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, but in all five states lost the official vote count. What are the odds on that?
Well, the odds are, don't belong in the realm of possibility. You're talking, millions, to one. You know, it's like winning the Super Lotto and the Powerball and, the pick five and six on the same night with four tickets.
Right. And, of course, we all know what Hillary said about this, which was
nothing.
Not a word. Now, I got to say, okay, we can, we need to deal with this. So you can go round and around on Hillary Clinton and blah, blah, blah. And, we all had our issues with Hillary Clinton. And I had my issues with her, but I felt that she could have been at least a competent president. And I didn't totally 100% lose Hillary Clinton until the day after the election. I mean, if Donald Trump had won the vote count by 2.8 million and had won the exit polls in those five states, but then was told that he had lost the election, do you think he would have gone out the next day and walked his dog? Come on. Hillary Clinton has not said a word about the Electoral College, has not said a word about anything to do with possible election fraud, has not said a word about the massive disenfranchisement of black and Hispanic voters prior to the election through cross-check and other means, Jim Crow means that, and we have to say at this point, at least they got a sense of humor. The appointment of Kris Kobach to be on an election commission is, can you characterize that one, Bob? I mean, wait a minute.
Before you do that, Bob, what you were just reciting, Harvey, is a total indictment, not just of Hillary Clinton, but of the Democratic Party. And so, coming back to what I said at the beginning of the program, we're not going to be able to succeed in this country if we still have a two-party system, even if it's still allowed in 2018 or 2020. We need a brand new political party that really represents the interests of the 90%, because we know the top 10% are beyond reach and are the real enemy at this point. So you know, trying to play within the current existing rules is going to get us nowhere fast. Bob, sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no problem. I was trying to, again, look at history, but it's an odd one. I mean, at any time you're putting, you know, the man most responsible for voter suppression, you know, into looking at if there was any voter suppression. I mean, yeah, he already, you know, Kobach's answer is, all right, not enough, right? It's not enough people were, in fact, suppressed. And again, all those issues, I can't agree with, you know, Don Moore, is that when you have that many people suppressed, and really the Democratic Party seems to roll over for it, it calls for a massive movement and some other party alternatives.
It's, well, we do have a Green Party. I mean, you are a prominent member of the Green Party. What
You're a card-carrying member of the Green Party.
That's right. I'm the co-chair here in Ohio.
Well, do Green Party members carry cards? I mean,
yeah, they're hemp. They got to be on hemp.
They have green cards.
Right. These are cards you don't give to people. You say, how you doing? Here's my card. Let's smoke it. So, but okay, is the Green Party not a viable third-party alternative?
I think it is, but what I find interesting, because yeah, I get emails all the time, and they're like, let's create a People's Party and get Bernie on the ballot in, you know, 50 states, and I'm like, oh, why don't we start with the party that's already on the ballot in 47 states, you know, that's been working for a decade, and let's work to get whoever we want on the ballot in all 50 states. So I don't know what it is, but a lot of people don't seem to realize that, you know, there's 50 different state systems. And that those systems, the one thing the two parties agree on the most is let's make it difficult for any other alternative, any third party, to get on the ballot. So the two major parties, which control most of the boards of election, have created a system where it's virtually impossible. So, you know, a third party like the Greens gets on in 47 states, and people are out thinking, let's build a new party from scratch. That's going to take a progressive party from scratch is going to take a decade. What really needs to happen is for the merger of the Bernie-crats, the Sanders people, that wing of the Democratic Party, breaking off and coming over to the Green Party and running progressive politics in a party that's already on the a ballot in 47 states. I mean, that's where the Republican Party came from. The Republican Party really was in a broke off from the Whig Party and from the Northern Democrats.
So, all right, so let's pick up on that. Hold on, one second. Let me identify you guys. That was Bob Fitchakis, my co-author of our new book, The Strip and Flip Disaster of America's Stolen Elections, just out, available on ebook and at freepress.org. And Don Goldmacher, maker of many, many films, including a new one. What's the title of your new film?
Yeah, the new one is called The Long Shadow, and it's an examination of slavery, white supremacy, and the dominant role of the South in the politics of the country from the very beginning to this very moment.
Okay.
Well, Harvey, that sounds like part of our book. Let's ask Don, is there a caste system? Harvey and I have argued it's wrong to think just in terms of class, particularly since Bacon's Rebellion and the laws for chattel slavery. I mean, there was a deliberate caste system created around color in the U.S., was there not?
Well, you got to watch the film, but it's not out yet. We're submitting to festivals. So, in reality, you know, when the colonies first appeared, black people were free people. They were not yet enslaved. It was only after, as you just rightfully mentioned, Bacon's Rebellion, that, you know, white men of property became terrified, and they set up a way for poor whites to have to invest, to gain some small benefits from being above people of color. So that was the way that white people were enticed into supporting slavery. Before that,
right.
whites and blacks were workers. We're indentured servants together.
Right. They were both members of the working class.
And people don't know this history whatsoever.
Right.
Did you ever learn that in high school? I certainly didn't. So, you know, this is another history lesson for us. And by the way, let me be clear. This is not my film. It is my co-producer from Heist Film, Frances Causey. She's the producer and director of this new film. She's a daughter of the South. She's a descendant of slaveholders. And so this is her real personal story intertwined with the entire history of our country and how she peels away the layers. I'm a producer on it, but it's not my movie. It's hers. And she deserves all the credit.
Since we're talking about the South, what we want to talk about now is nullification. The nullification of the 2016 election. This, it seems to me, in terms of a sane outcome here, is our only route. Impeachment's not going to happen.
Yep.
And if it did, we wind up with
theocracy.
The Gang of Four there. Mm-hmm. So how do we wage a credible campaign, including, Don, which you started the show with, nonviolent resistance, to nullify the 2016 election and have a new presidential election, let's say, in the fall of 2017 or the fall of 2018, sometime before 2020, which we are not likely to survive to with Donald Trump. How do we do this?
Yeah. Well, look, you've already seen mobilizations of parts of the population, quote, resist Donald Trump. They haven't resisted. You know, they've marched, they've demonstrated, they're making phone calls, they're pointing and clicking on their computers. They're going to congressional, in the congressman's home on recess or whatever, screaming and ranting. But again, there's a lack of a strategy. However, there are millions and millions of people who are rightfully very, very upset, but don't know what to do. So the people have called, for example, the Women's March and then the Climate March and then the Scientist March. We have to say, hey, listen, folks, instead of protesting him being in the White House, why aren't we demanding that this election be nullified? And put that out as a theme. We can certainly start to float it on social media, because really, you have to bring all these individual social movements together into one unified social movement first before we can even begin to think about how to do this. And if they're not willing to do it, then you have the typical fragmentation on the left. And as Timothy Snyder, this Yale professor, said, we have possibly a year, maybe two, before democracy is shut down in America for good. So the clock is ticking, but we should put out a call. We should get a number of people together to sign a call nationally, take out an ad in the New York Times and say, why are we abiding by this election when we know it was stolen? I'm sorry, when we know it was illegal to begin with. Why are we abiding by the results? So, you know, those are a little set of tactics. But again, you need an overarching strategy of how you're going to make this happen.
Rob?
No, I'm thinking there does need to be a campaign because, I mean, there's a lot of factors here. Mm-hmm. Number one, I think we have been properly cautious on what would look like a coup d'etat. It would not be beneficial if Trump was simply removed.
Right.
Here in Ohio at the Capitol, the last Trump rally saw, paramilitary forces, with civilian versions of M16s and paid armed militias. That's what you usually don't see at political rallies for a candidate, even if he's president. So there's a really scary kind of underbelly, which I think would not respond well and see this as a coup d'etat. Now, at the same time, while we're going after Trump and making the case, we really need to indict the whole system and point out that Trump is the product of what essentially is a fraudulent system, an undemocratic system, which he himself has spelled out. So in that case, and why can't we revote? If we were a parliament, it's written into the process. So, you know, we need to show it's illegal, it's illegitimate, and call for a revote. I think through that process, whether we achieve it or not, you know, we can indict the whole system that not only produced Trump, but seems to be able to produce whoever the hell they want at any given moment, whether it's a, you know, a George W. Bush attacking the wrong country after 9/11.
Well, it's really, I mean, I'm struggling to figure out what kinds of, okay, there's a strategy. The strategy, I suppose, is to win a campaign to nullify the 2016 election, mm-hmm. to have a do-over. Now, there's no legal process for this whatsoever, which is the point. There's nothing in the Constitution, no historical precedent. Gene Sharp, who you cited in the beginning, Don, has a book on nonviolent strategies, almost 200 different strategies. There's one in there I've been kicking around that I don't think is in there, and that is, I've discussed it with Bob, what if the country, what if our grassroots movement announced that we will not pay our credit cards until Trump is removed, until there's a new election?
Right. So that's a tactic.
What would happen to the financial system if that happened?
Well, that's a tactic known as boycott, right? It's a financial boycott, and it's certainly part of the armamentarium of a grand strategy. But it's not a strategy, it's a tactic. So you have to weigh whether that specific tactic is useful and what's the end goal. So what you want to do is cause the collapse of, you know, MasterCard and Visa and possibly banks. And what are the ramifications of that? So all I'm arguing is that when we bandy about different tactics or different actions to take, they have to be thought through very carefully, very deeply to say, what would be the outcome? You know, in other words, as the CIA itself predicted when they overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh, we better watch out for blowback, right? So
yeah.
You have to, you know, and as Native Americans would say, we have to think seven generations down. What will be the impact of what we do now? So in devising tactics and campaigns and strategies, we have to be thoughtful. I'm not opposed to it. I think it's a very clever way to implement an economic boycott, and we could target either credit cards or very specific corporations that are allied with Trump. Which would make it more meaningful so that people understand we're going to hit any corporation that lends any kind of support to Trump, whether it's an ExxonMobil, whether it's Chase Manhattan or Goldman Sachs, which has three of their major people in his administration. So yes, all of these things can be thought through and sifted through and said, which ones will work? Which ones will the population respond to best? That initially won't be harmful to them individually, but would have a real impact. So credit cards might be a way.
Bob?
Well, you know, I think that's obviously one of many tactics. I like it because it reflects back to Occupy and you know, the investment casino
mm-hmm.
Bankers. And really, the penalties are quite limited, right? So you're going to mess your credit up somewhat. But there's no debtor's prison in our country. I mean, a lot of
not
people,
yet.
I mean, what are the consequences? And if enough people do it, if it's a mass campaign, they'll have to adjust the credit to keep the system afloat. So it, in some ways, it's a tactic that is very well protected and that people might actually like to do.
See, I think there's a little problem with it in the sense that, yes, people would then be running up larger and larger interest rate on the outstanding balances, and I don't think they would like to do that. Plus, their credit rating could get impaired. I think a better way perhaps to do it would be to say, all of you folks who have your money in this particular bank, let's say Wells Fargo, since we know what they've been up to, why don't you move your money out of Wells Fargo? Stop banking there. Move it to a local credit union. Move it to a local community bank. Just get it out of Wells Fargo. If we had a few million people, or let's say 10 million people do that en masse, thus destroying one bank in one fell swoop, that's a real statement.
Okay, so, let's look back at what's worked. In India, Gandhi boycotted salt, and everybody in India needed salt. He did have an impact on the British system, although, you know, he made a deal earlier, in the campaign that a lot of people thought did not really amount to a big victory. On the other hand, it did give him the stature. The British had to negotiate with him. I just read a pretty detailed analysis of this. And, so he picked a universal element of Indian life. In Montgomery, they boycotted the buses. And that worked. That was pretty effective, actually. As Yogi Berra says, if people aren't going to come to the ball game, you can't stop them. So if people aren't going to ride the buses, you can't stop them. What would they do? Of course, there was economic pressure put on South Africa, and there's now economic pressure being put on Israel in the form of boycotts and things like that. So divestment, yes. So, I don't think anything will work to remove Trump that doesn't have a massive economic impact. I may be wrong. I don't know. What is possible to organize around that?
Well, if again, hearkening back to what Sharp lays out here, flowing from a grand strategy has to be what's the focus in the near term? Is the issue a political issue? Is the issue an economic issue? I would argue that right now, this is a political issue mostly, and the game is playing. The drama is being played out in the political arena, not the economic arena. That doesn't mean we can't focus on two campaigns in a way. One that makes the economic governance of the country more and more untenable by focusing in on a specific boycott campaign of a corporation or credit cards, while simultaneously demanding that the 2000 election be nullified and that we need a do-over. So those could be two parallel campaigns. But again, making that happen, given the fractured nature of our social movements, is challenging. But nevertheless, it could be put out publicly and say, hey, here's the choices facing us. We put up with this madness, or we deeply challenge it. Resistance is not enough. We need to go beyond resistance.
Bob?
No, I think there's a variety of things, and in different states, different movements. It's clear it should be coordinated, and it's clear that there should be some national mobilization. But a lot of this to work really has to happen, at local and state levels. In fact, I remember, the movement we're all part of, for election integrity. I remember Don at the time arguing that there needed to be a conference in the Bay Area and one at the University of Michigan, and then a national movement, and the movement would, in fact, grow. So Don actually organized one of the organizers of the conference out in San Francisco, and we fought for years now, and I think there's been some headway made, particularly into realizing computerized election machines can be hacked. And, when I went on a tour after we did a conference, on that tour was Ann Arbor, But people came out of the woodwork. People knew there was a problem. I mean, I was very doubtful that the people were organizing themselves. And I believe if we can break through with critical mass, people know what to do. They know how to resist. They know their skills, whether it's writing or heckling or willing to take a rest or willing to move money out of institutions. People are afraid, and people are more active. There's people that I've taught with, for 30 years that have never done anything, and, they're now out 5 days a week because of Donald Trump. People are ready to be put in motion, and with a critical mass, I think it would, in fact, cause his ouster. Ours is to make sure what comes with it is not the replacement by a more efficient reactionary figure that in many ways may be worse than Trump, but by an actual fair election, a free and fair election.
Bob, let me just piggyback on, just to be not theoretical here and very on the ground and take note of what is happening. The indivisible groups, there are like 7,000 of them that have been created in like every city, county, state, blah, blah, across the country. And they're quote, doing things, right? They're doing things.
Right.
They're going to these, as I alluded to earlier, when the congressional people come home and have their town hall meetings, they've been mobbing these town hall meetings. They've been writing letters. They've been making phone calls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And a good friend of mine last night, who I had dinner with, pointed out that in her local environment, in her little city, in Marin County, California, probably the wealthiest in the country or close to it or used to be, it's essentially been hijacked by OFA, Organizing for America, which is Obama's little group, right? Not so little.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there's the danger. But to their credit, these indivisible groups have harnessed all this energy of people not knowing what else to do, right?
Right.
So they're not going far enough.
And I think
maybe there's a way to
the AstroTurf.
Sorry?
Because the Democratic Party, on the corporate level, the DLC does not want this to get out of control.
Yep.
And in the same way, the Koch brothers had to go out and take an indigenous, Tea Party. That was opposed to bailouts and make it into AstroTurf, make it into a pro-corporate, pro-oil and gas movement by eliminating the libertarians, by eliminating the right-wing populists that were pro-union and pro-made in America. So I think that's the same process. The People's Justice Project has a lot of money in it from George Soros in the Black Lives Matter movement. The key thing is to make sure that the forces that are there are actually independent and not being manipulated from above by one of the two major corporate parties.
So we just got a couple minutes left. I very quickly want to point out that in my world, the Russians are not our enemy. This is a mafia operation that Trump is running. The Russian government, Putin, these are mafia guys. There's no ideology here. It's all about the money. And it is, in a certain sense, a refreshing turn from the Cold War with all this crap about communism versus capitalism. These guys are just thugs and thieves. And, the same with the guy in Turkey and the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
These are all just good fellows out there to steal whatever they can. And Putin, being at the top of the list, I mean, he's the mafia master.
Well, Russia, they're kleptocrats.
Yes. Russia is not our enemy, for God's sakes. You hear all this crap all the time. They're not our. They're just the competitors, and they're being run by a mafia cabal. And I have to point out that Andrew Jackson himself was basically a mafia guy. He's the last guy who really blatantly and overtly personally profited from the presidency. I mean, the Cherokee removal, he got some of that land, and he was a slave owner and a slave driver, for God's sakes. So this is not a World War situation. This is just a gotta go. Hey, Don,
wait a minute.
Don Goldmacher, Bob Petraeus, I'll have you back. Thanks so much. We'll be
from dictatorship to democracy.
You got it, buddy, and we'll talk to you soon.
We needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.